I think I learned much more in here than in dental school about sleep. Hi everyone, welcome to another episode of The Bi-Angle. Over here we have Dr. Simona Olay. Yes, all right. And Dr. Simona is an expert of sleep, and she's also a dentist. And here we're going to talk more about how dentistry and sleep are intertwined together, and how we can how dentists can actually help with your sleep problems. All right, so Simona, can you talk more about yourself first, and why are you in Singapore?
Okay, so I'm a general dentist by training, and just by a coincidence, I got across dental sleep medicine, and I somehow fell in love with this field because it just makes so much sense to me. So I decided to educate myself more in this field. And hence, I attended the American Academy of Dental Sleep Medicine, the mastery courses. Later, I graduated through American Board of Dental Sleep Medicine. So I earned my international certificate status from them.
Wow.
And since then, I could not stop diving deeper and deeper. And it eventually led me to starting my PhD at the National University of Singapore in this field as well.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Okay. And which faculty are you at now?
Dentistry.
Okay. Wow. So you're currently doing your PhD in...
Yes.
Okay. Wow. That's a lot of achievements.
There's also a lot of work we did.
Yes. A lot of studying as well. Okay. And like, you know, in dental school, I remember, I mean, I don't know your dental school, because you're from Czechoslovakia,
yes,
right?
Yes.
We didn't really know anything about sleep at all. Like, it was such a...
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the situation didn't change much. It was very similar back in Czech Republic as I studied at Charles University in Prague. So luckily, we had some rounds at the hospitals. And we had to study internal medicine as part of my
curriculum. Wow, it's actually pretty comprehensive. I didn't get my chance of doing at all.
Okay.
So I'm like... I just know that, okay, sleep can be affected with dentistry, but like, I don't know how exactly and what are the signs to look for.
Okay, so to understand sleep, we need to remember a bit about the anatomy of the upper airways.
Mm.
When you go back in your mind, I'm sure you will remember that the upper airways is basically a muscle tube that does not really have any support of cartilage compared to the lower airways, right? Or any bony support.
So it's just muscles.
Yeah, it's like a muscle tube.
And fats and everything.
And it can become floppy.
Yeah.
Especially as we age, the muscle tension will go down, right? So that's one of the reasons why sleep apnea can occur. But it's multifactorial.
Yeah.
But important thing is to keep in mind it's a muscle tube, and because of it's a muscle tube, we can constrict it. Whether it's like because of the fat deposits that will be around
it,
that can make it more narrow, or can be issue with the muscles, whether there is a lack of muscle responsiveness to the neural inputs. Or the tension is lower as we age. So then the tube can actually collapse. If this happens, the complete collapse occurs for at least 10 seconds, this will be considered an apneic event. If the muscle tube collapses only partially, let's say there is still 30% opening, this is still considered a hypopnea.
Okay, so that's more like snoring.
Yeah. I mean,
snoring considered?
Snoring is little bit something else.
Okay.
I will explain.
Yeah.
But what I'm getting is that we need to understand there is a complete cessation of breathing, that is happening even, and there is partial. collapse. The patient can be still breathing, but it's very difficult for them. This is still causing an issue. Later I can explain. So
you can tell that you're so passionate about this subject. You just go. This is really good.
A basic understanding when we are communicating with the sleep physicians, because they will be speaking language of AHI index, apnea, hypopnea index. Mm-hmm. So we need to understand what they are talking about.
Yeah.
So the snoring is something else. It's not reflected in this index. And the snoring sound actually occurs when there is some blockage on the way of the air that is coming through the nose or through the mouth. It should not, but the nose. And it's coming inside and it's hitting some floppy tissue on the way. Typically, it's the soft palate. That can become floppy, and so when it goes inside the air, it hits the floppy tissue and
it starts doing this.
so this is the snoring sound, vibration.
So snoring doesn't mean that you have a bad sleep.
So not everyone who snores have sleep apnea.
Yep.
And not everyone who have sleep apnea snores. However, it's still one of the main signs. Especially if you have so-called like habitual snoring, meaning if you snore occasionally because you have allergy, there is allergy season, for example, or if you have flu and you snore, that's still considered okay. It will
that's
go
normal.
Away.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, it will come and go. But if you have a habitual snoring, meaning you are snoring habitually for 3 nights a week and more and continuously, this should trigger an alarm in your head and you should get checked, because the habitual snoring, there is a reason why it's happening and it's not physiological.
I want to ask, like, does the volume of snoring have an effect? Like, you know, some people snore very loud.
So this really depends on the gender, I would say, maybe.
Okay.
So typically a man are known to have a very loud.
That's what my wife
snoring.
Said to me. It's like, it's like saying that there's a deer or moose bee.
yes. So this is a typical thing that wives usually complains about the husband having very loud snoring, and it often leads to a sleep divorce, that you are
like you sleep in a different place, right?
Move out to the sofa or somewhere. Yes.
It's very interesting called sleep divorce. Yeah.
However, in a woman who has sleep apnea, the snoring might not be that pronounced. Can be very light, for example.
Okay.
And then also one thing is that there is some kind of stigma, social stigma, that woman who snores doesn't really talk about it.
I'm fat now.
Want to really mention this symptom. So
yes.
If you have a patient on your dental chair, for example, you really need to pay attention whether it's a man or a woman, because they have different symptomatology.
Yes. So in our questionnaire, we tend to have like, do you snore at night? Do you have restless sleep at night? And things like that as well. But does it affect your core? Like if I'm snoring louder than usual, do I have a higher chance that I have a worse sleep?
So, what does it mean, worse sleep? Because definitely your wife will have worse sleep. That's for sure. But also, there is a study that connected snoring, the vibration of snoring, with the accumulation of the plaque in the big arteries on your neck.
Okay.
So,
so plaque is not the dental plaque. It's the real fat, the fatty plaques, right?
Yeah. Okay. I believe the stronger the snoring, the vibration is, maybe the effect may be more pronounced.
Yeah, and it's a downward spiral, because there's more plaque there, there's fattier and everything like that. That could really help. That could really worsen the situation as well, right? Okay, cool. Wow. See, I learned something new again. And so, you know, with regards to how do you, can dentists diagnose sleep disorders, or do we have to go to a sleep doctor to get it done?
Okay, yeah. So as you mentioned at the beginning, our curriculum didn't really teach us.
Yeah, right? Absolutely.
So what we can do, we can educate ourselves postgraduate.
Okay, yeah.
But this does not give us
the right
to make a diagnosis.
Yeah.
And we should acknowledge this.
Okay.
Acknowledge this. And rather we should really try to collaborate and cooperate very closely with the sleep physicians who are experts in this field and can make a proper diagnosis so that we don't mess up something.
Yeah.
Because it is a complex topic. It is. And as a dentist, I believe we can play a very, very important part for the screening part.
So what can if I just graduated from dental school, and what are the signs that I should look for in a mouth?
Okay.
In a patient that I'd be warning signs.
Another thing that's important to understand, beside that the upper airways is a floppy tube, floppy muscle tube, is we need to imagine the oral cavity as a box. So can imagine as box.
As a box, yeah.
At the back here is the airways, and this is the front of the
mouth.
Okay, so this box is made of the upper and lower jaw, the bony tissues. And here are the teeth. Okay, the
fingers are teeth.
So this is our box.
Yeah.
And the more things that will be in the box will make it more crowded. Or if the box is smaller, the soft tissues inside will not have space to fit in. Meaning, if you have a patient that has narrow arches or crowded teeth, this will eventually make a smaller space for their tongue. So where will the tongue go? Obviously not outside of the mouth, but it will have a tendency to collapse in the airways and block them. So that's one thing, how are the dental arches? How are the teeth? Are they crowded? Are they not? Another thing that we can look out for is the exostosis on the bony tissues that can make space smaller.
Yeah.
Then another thing is if even the arches are nicely wide, but let's say the patient has a macroglossian.
Like
so the tongue is too big, it will not fit no matter what.
Okay.
And again, it will find space where to go and it will be in the back, in the throat. Then another thing is the soft palate that is over here, the uvula.
Yeah.
You can have a look how big it is, what is the tension of the uvula, is it too long, is it too thick, is it collapsing in the airways. So there's another thing to look for. And then tonsils, but these ones is a very important factor mostly in kids, but some patients, even adults, can have big tonsils that can again make the space smaller.
Okay.
Yeah, and then another thing, but it's usually dentist does not really look inside the nose, but but when the patient is there and you can see he's breathing, and for example one of his nostrils is collapsing. When they
breathe in,
but the nostril will collapse. There's also something that maybe you mentioned to the patient to see the ENT to check.
Okay.
And then of course there are adenoids in the nose, but we have no way to see
everything.
But if you can sense that the patient is not breathing properly, the nose is blocked and it's not allergy, so that's another thing when I would refer to ENT. And then another thing is if the patient fall asleep in your chair. Yeah.
Okay. Sometimes it's a good compliment. They like,
yeah,
you know, you're very gentle.
Yeah, this is what I thought also. When I used to be very happy when my patients fall asleep in the dental chair, but now
like, oh, I'm very careful. I'm very gentle.
This is what I thought, but now I know that they are just excessively sleepy and there is something going on with them. It should not be like that. Even if you are the most delicate dentist, they should not be falling asleep in your dental chair.
Okay. That's a good question. Yeah. It's a good thing to know. Yeah. Now I know. All right. And do like skeletal issues play a part? Like, you know, jaws pushing back, forward, backwards, things like that.
Yeah. So definitely if you see patients that has a smaller jaw, lower or the upper, the box will be smaller, right? So okay. It will make the box itself will become smaller. Often you can see it in a Chinese population compared to Caucasians or Indians or even Malays, that the jaws are a little bit smaller. In general, the upper airways of the Chinese origin patients, they have more narrow airways. And there was a study a few years back done at the NUH by Dr. Tan. And they figure out that actually Chinese people experience symptoms of sleep apnea at the lower BMIs compared to Indians and Malays. They needed, for example, much higher BMIs to suffer. And this was
Is it because of the skeletal?
Yes, because you have naturally your airways is a little bit more narrow.
Okay.
So you have a predisposition for sleep apnea.
Yeah, issues. And I think the Asian, I guess it's Mongoloid, I think. Is it Mongoloid? Yeah, like so basically we also have smaller arches.
Yes.
So there's more the teeth tend to be more crowded.
Yes.
And then it pushes us back everything in.
Yes,
as well.
The nature is against you guys.
Unfortunately. Yeah, no, so I think there's a lot of, so how can we, so as a dentist, what are the, when you see all these signs, what should a dentist do? Should they refer to a sleep study first?
Definitely, you can implement the questionnaires. I mean, the patients are waiting in your waiting room anyway, doing nothing or scrolling on their phone. Mm-hmm. So you can have a dedicated team member who can give them a questionnaire.
Okay.
They are very simple. The questionnaire takes 2 minutes to fill out. Typically, it's a stop bend questionnaire, which one is asking about snoring, tiredness, blood pressure, observed apnea, even during the night, gender, age, neck circumference, and BMI.
Okay.
So these are very simple questions. They can be filled in very quickly.
Yeah.
So it's like very easy screening tool, costs you really nothing. But if you see that they score at least 3 points or more, this gives you a way how to open the topic with your patient. And eventually, the good approach is to send them for a sleep study with a sleep physician. They will make the diagnosis. And let's say if the patient is only snoring or is mild to moderate sleep apnea, the patient has a very good chance will come back to you for the oral appliance. But let's not forget the severe cases, because we can still help tremendously with the severe cases as well. So typically the severe sleep apnea with HI index over 30.
That means they are waking up 30 times a minute? Was it
so at least they were not breathing properly at least 30 times per hour.
Per hour, okay.
Or more, yes. Typically these patients, the first line therapy is a CPAP machine. It's like a compressor that delivers air into your airways, and the compressed air keeps the airways open from inside. So typically, this is the first line therapy. However, we know that with the CPAP, the compliance is a bit lower.
It's like having a tube and everything.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it's not that comfortable to wear. And
it's quite noisy as well, some of them.
Actually, the new machines should not be.
Okay. Seems like it's like Darth Vader, you know. You can hear that.
Yeah. Yeah. So you see, some patients, they are very good and they are able to comply with this treatment.
Yeah.
But there is a group of patients that just cannot. So we need to help them. And you can either do combinational therapy where you create an oral appliance. You help to open the airways with the oral appliance so that the physician can reduce the pressure in the compressor.
So okay.
They wear both. They wear the oral appliance inside the mouth and they wear the mask, but with the lower pressure. So this helps patients. But then you have still the group which will, no matter what, no wear CPAP, no.
Okay.
And yeah. For example, they are either not good candidate or they does not just want do, yeah. Surgery.
Yeah.
So then only what is left is the oral appliance for them. So they are treated at least a bit. Maybe we are not able to treat them completely if they are severe cases, but we can at least remove of sleep apnea by, I don't know, half. That's still good. Still, okay. Still better than nothing.
Okay. But what are the surgeries involved? Because I talked to Mei Hui. I don't know if you know me. Dr. Tan. Mei Hui. And she is an oral surgeon. And she was talking to me about moving the jaw forwards.
But you need to have a right profile.
Yeah. So it's based on your face profile, right?
Yeah.
Because you cannot have a nice face and you move it forward.
No. It doesn't work like that.
Yeah.
No. You must have some insufficiency, the bone insufficiency, malocclusion, so that they... It makes sense to move, right?
Otherwise, you're making it like, why is this guy...
Done? No. Yeah, but okay. There are many different techniques. This is just one of them. Yeah. There is also techniques on the soft palate. If, for example, if that is the reason of your sleep apnea, if your soft palate is too long or too floppy or too thick and it makes sense to reduce it, maybe there's a good option for you. I'm personally... I'm not a big fan of this surgery because once you cut it, you can never bring it back, right?
Yeah, so, but I mean, it's too much for a reason, right? So does it recur?
It really needs to be a good match of patient profile with the surgical procedure. Yes.
Yeah, I know. I think in one of my podcasts, I actually said that my son actually had. Sleep apnea. So the only way we could find it was because we had a webcam in his room, and then he was like turning like about 60 times a night. So and then when he wakes up the next day, he looks tired, and then the childcare, because he was only like 4 years old, the childcare was like your boy has. Maybe special needs because he was just staring into space. Then I'm like, no, he doesn't look like it because on a weekend, he looks like he's playing very well and things like that. And because I'm a healthcare professional, I know what's the differences and things like that. But then I was like, no. So we looked at the footage and like, okay, this one is probably sleep apnea. So he saw pediatrician ENT who did a scope and it was like 80% blocked at the noise. So we decided to remove the everything. We removed the adenoids, tonsils, and also the uvula as well. So that was all removed as well. And then he can sleep really well. He's only waking up like once a night or twice a night. So it's quite good.
So are you sure they removed his uvula as well? Are you sure?
I'm sure. I will check.
Because these are two different procedures that you are describing. Okay. So... Typically,
No, he didn't remove the blah, blah, blah. I remember it now. It's turbinates, adenoids, and tonsils.
Yeah.
Yes. So yeah, yeah. Why is it, why do people not remove uvula? Is there a reason why?
So, okay. So first, let me just explain that in kids, the main reason for sleep apnea is enlarged adenoids in the nose or tonsils in the throat.
Yes.
Or there can be combination of both. So removing them can solve the issue.
Okay.
But this again needs to be a properly chosen profile of the child and good timing because we know that these tissues go through nodes, stages of growth and then reduction naturally. So example, we know they shrink around 13 years of age. So if your child would be 12 and half. I think they will wait maybe half a year to see.
Yeah.
If it doesn't get better, then they will do the surgery. Mm-hmm. But of course, if the child was 4 years old, it needs to be intervened.
Yeah.
So, and in the adults, usually we don't have these issues because these tissues are shrinked already. That's typically, but not 100%. But usually the issue is with the soft pellet. Because it can enlarge, becomes more floppy.
Even for kids?
No, adults.
Oh, adults, oh, yeah, okay, adults, yeah, yeah.
So it can become more floppy. But I would like to mention that with the oral appliances, as we are moving lower jaw forward, we are not only bringing the tongue outside of the airways, but through palatopharyngeal arches, the muscles there which are connected to the lower jaw, we are pulling it. And creating tension on the soft palate as well.
Oh, so you're not increasing just volume, but you're increasing the tension of
yes,
the muscles.
Yes, yes. So we bring everything outside of the airways and we are creating the tension there as well. We are not only bringing the lower jaw forward, but we are also fixing it in a particular position. And I said I'm not a big fan of uvulopalatopharyngoplasty. It's when they remove all the soft palate with the uvula, because some cases we can treat with the oral appliances just by creating the tension and bringing lower jaw forward. Of course, some cases maybe not. But once you do the UPPP, you cut everything, it will never grow back. Some patients might complain that when they are eating the soup, the noodles and the soup end up in the nose because there is no the natural.
So the uvula is blocking away,
yeah,
right?
It's giving you the direction, go this way.
Yeah, go this way, okay.
Don't go up. You know,
okay,
so for example, that's one of the thing, and some patient may scar, unfortunately, in a bad way. They have this predisposition that their scar become like more strong. Mm-hmm. So you cut it away, and then the scar tissue will eventually make it the same bad.
So there's recurrence, basically.
Yeah, it could. So I'm careful with this. ENTs will tell you other way. They are very happy doing this. You know, it's
yeah,
about,
I know.
Yeah. About the I'm so more opinion, conservative yeah. person.
I mean, we can try without first and then see if it works. If it works, then great. If it doesn't, then we can look at it again, right? Yeah.
Yes. But once you do this one, you can never go back. Yeah.
Yes. And then, so talking about oral appliances, there's so many different brands, different styles, and like, I think we need to do a whole entire course on this, by the way.
Yes.
But I think the most important thing would be patient compliance. I think that would be the most.
Yeah. So yeah. What I usually do back in Prague in my office is I give patients an options.
Okay.
So I invite them in my decision when I'm building the oral appliance.
Yeah.
And this will make them feel like I chose this and will increase the compliance.
So oh, yes, that's a good idea.
How I do it is that I do the proper examination and now I see, okay, this patient maybe will be better for this and this and this type of appliance. So I give him the options. Okay, for your profile, you can choose from this. I don't give them the others that might not be a good solution for them.
That's so, a good way.
Yeah. So I already pre-screen them and then I give them options. These ones you can choose from. And then we discuss the materials, we discuss the designs, we discuss pros and cons. And then we eventually make a common decision that, okay, this one maybe will be the best for you.
And then, I mean, so speaking from personal experience, there are some patients of mine who want to get a sleep apnea device because, you know, you can buy it off the counter nowadays, right? You can buy it. And number one, how are over-the-counter sleep appliances?
Okay, so This is a big topic, and I maybe will have a little bit controversial opinion here.
But okay.
Let's explain. So over-the-counter appliances, which patients can order from online,
yeah.
I do not recommend. Typically, the materials are not good. They does not serve the purpose that we need in oral appliances, and can lead to either TMJ issues,
yeah.
bite changes, or usually the designs are also not sufficient. They might not have the ability to protrude as much as we need. And then also patients are not professionals. They usually cannot create them as good as if the dentist...
Yeah, so I had one case where I wouldn't name the brand, but it was the patient bought it off online, and then he used it and he said he complained of pain, yes. muscles, things like that, because they sort of... The patient takes the bite themselves, some
of them. Yeah, which can be very tricky.
Yeah, and then like, oh, this is okay, I don't snore now, but my muscles are aching, yes, here, kind of thing. So, that's a very
big
thing.
So this one I really, really don't recommend for patients to try on their own.
Okay.
However, there are temporary oral appliances which are on the market and are made by companies that are making also the custom-made appliances.
Mm.
And these temporary appliances, a patient cannot buy. Only dental office can order. And I use them in my office.
So stock. It's not like customized. Those are not customized.
You customize as a dentist. You customize it. The chair is ball and by appliance.
Ah, okay.
But the design follows the custom appliance.
Yeah.
Meaning even the range of motion. And we know that it's only a temporary device. And the materials are also good enough that can create a good retention.
Mm.
So it's excellent temporary device, and I like to use it for patients who are not sure whether oral appliance is good for them.
Mm. Or the cost is quite too high for a regular
but
one.
But it's
as
only
well.
Temporary for like 6 months. So, the cost of the final
so
one,
is a trial.
But you will eventually, if it works for you, have to get there.
Yes, yes.
So it's very important to make clear to the patient that it's just a temporary device. You can just try it out, whether you will be a good candidate for oral appliances, like if you can reduce your AHI sufficiently, or you can try whether it will, like some patients have issue sleeping with that, it bothers them in their mouth, maybe they figure out, okay, this is not for me. Or there are patients that need immediate treatment, but they also need dental restorations, like changing of bridges or having implants, crowns, fillings, I don't know, a lot of dental work. So you can't really make them a custom appliance, but you need to treat them because they refuse using CPAP.
Yeah.
But this appliance, you can remodel it as many times as you need, and it's quite quick. So, example, you know that you have to make a bridge for them or crown.
Yeah.
So you first do this ball and bite, and then in 1 month or I don't know when, you install the bridge, you remodel it again, chair side, very quick. And then you can continue fillings or whatever until you finalize all your dental
then you
work.
The permanent one.
Then you go to the custom one.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
And then especially I think this is a good option for the sleep apnea during pregnancy, because this one is usually a temporary issue, pregnancy related, and you don't really need a custom appliance worth of few thousands of dollars just for a couple of months and postpartum period. Usually within 6 months you can cover this. Yeah.
Okay, that's very interesting. I wanted to go through that very soon. One question I have is that I have a lot of patients that come in and say, I don't want to see a sleep doctor. I just want to get the appliance because I have this snore guard that works for me or not work for me. Or my wife say I'm snoring, so I'm exploring options and I just want to go and get something that I can try to reduce my snoring, but not a diagnosis proper.
Okay, so these patients, I know they can be a bit stubborn.
Yeah.
But this is your reputation is in stake.
Yeah.
So you need to keep in mind that. And my approach towards them is I explain to them that it's a very complex issue. Sleep apnea can be also central sleep apnea, for example. We need to...
Central means that it's brain mediated.
Central means that the patient is actually not breathing. They are not getting the input from the brain to catch a breath.
Okay, yeah.
So
the stimulus issue is...
So, example, if the patient would be suffering from central sleep apnea and I would put him on oral appliance, I would do no good to him.
Do no good, or is it do worse?
I don't think do worse. He will just basically not be treated.
Not be treated. But with that said, is there any negative impact of sleep apnea device?
Sleep apnea device. Well, we know there are side effects, that's why it has to be very individual approach.
Yes.
So each patient, at least in my clinic, we measure their bite. So we measure how much they can move the lower jaw forward, backward. We establish their range of motion. Then we also look at how severe the sleep apnea is. And many other inputs. And based on all these inputs, as I mentioned, I'm more conservative. So, and also the research show us that increasing or protruding beyond 75% of your range of motion will do maybe little benefit, but you will have higher chance of side effects.
Mm.
So I really try to keep my patients within the range of up to 75%. But there are, of course, patients that can tolerate and need to go beyond it.
Mm.
But you need to keep in mind this one.
So you go smaller first and then you increase it.
I typically do like that. Okay. But there are different approaches. Some clinicians like to set up everyone 50%, 75%. I don't know. For me, I play with every patient and we are trying to find the treatment position.
Yeah.
So
therapeutic position.
Yes, therapeutic. Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
So that I can eliminate as much as possible side effects.
Yeah.
So we know that oral appliances, they depends on which design you use. So where are the connectors in between upper and lower jaw and what are the forces that are in this particular appliance? Because the forces eventually can move the teeth a bit. But we are talking about 0.2 millimeters maybe. So typically, even if this occurs, patients are usually unaware. Only you as a dentist will notice.
Mm-hmm.
And the benefit of wearing this appliance is still higher than not wearing it. Or not being treated.
Yeah, you can see
better. Another thing what you can do is we are living in a technological age full of digital dentistry, right? Mm-hmm. So when you take scans of the patient, you have the initial bite, you have the initial teeth position, everything.
Yeah.
And if you see that, let's say, there are any movements happening, because you should really follow up on your patients, not just give them oral appliance and bye-bye. No.
Yeah.
They should come back regularly to visit you so that you can check whether the appliance does not have any issues, there are no cracks, for example, is serving us our purpose, and whether there is any bite changes happening or whether the patient is having any issues. So if you see something happening, it's very easy. You send the scans and you will create a copy of the aligners, basically. Mm-hmm. So
you can ask
them, for example, okay, after you remove your oral appliance in the morning, just wear this one for day or a couple of days. You should prevent a lot of issues.
Have you seen jaw movements? Like there's some issues with some fear that you might move the jaw irreversibly into a certain position.
Not really,
and
jaw.
Get a different bite.
No. What's happening is that if your tooth, some of the teeth moves, example, your lower teeth, and this is the upper teeth,
mm-hmm.
and they move like that,
mm-hmm.
then this one, the upper teeth will be biting in different position, but you are not changing the jaw. you are just the bite is different.
The teeth
so
is moving only.
So you are biting in different position, so you can create a posterior open bite, for example.
Yes. But it's because of the teeth that has moved, not the jaw.
It's not the jaw. It's the teeth are biting in different position. So where the aligner bring the teeth back,
it should be back.
Goes back.
So it's the same issue. Okay.
Yeah.
The same treatment. Okay. Because there's a lot of fear that people, you know, some of them say, hey, we need to have a repositioner in the morning.
It's repositioner
it
is good.
It's good.
I like to use it because imagine that you are stretching the muscles and the muscle is stretched all night. And then you remove it suddenly like that. Some patients have difficulties to bring
find their bite back.
Find the bite exactly.
Yeah.
So it helps them easier. You just put it in the mouth and chew on it on the way to work. You don't even notice that you are doing any exercises. Mm-hmm. And it will help you to bring the bite back.
Okay. Yeah. No, really good idea. Wow. That's a lot of things to take in today. And I want to know more about pregnancy because you mentioned to me that pregnancy has issues with an increased sleep apnea. Am I right to say that? Is it because there's more flexibility or more?
No. So again, this is multifactorial. So firstly, I would like to mention the difference in genders or symptomatology. For so long time, it was believed that the sleep apnea is just a male disease. Right, it's coming back all the way to Pickwickian papers. If you heard about the Pickwick novel, it's an English novel where there was a Mr. Pickwick and he was described as a very rotund gentleman that was very round, very sleepy, and actually the author didn't know that he's actually describing a proper sleep apnea. Yes.
Okay.
But all the way back there, from the people believed it's just a male disease. Male disease. Eventually, we figure out that, for example, Chinese origin people or men does not need to be obese to have sleep apnea. So firstly, the obesity, no need to be. Okay? Mm. You can be just
regular size.
Yes. Have sleep apnea. And then eventually...
So regular size means that your BMI is within range, but you still can get sleep apnea.
Because it's multifactorial, have sleep apnea due to different...
In Chinese people, there's higher likelihood that your BMI should be lower, but you still can get...
It can be slightly higher, but you no need to be obese, really.
Okay.
But because in Chinese people, there is other factors playing role.
The teeth
so
and
you don't need to be even higher BMI. Can
That's
be
sad,
normal.
Man. That's sad for me.
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
So finally, the research recognized that actually women also can suffer from sleep apnea, mm-hmm. despite for a very long time they believe women does not have it, but they does, especially after the menopause. This can happen. Actually, after the menopause, the woman has same chance as a man.
Oh, okay.
So it's equal finally. So, but also a specific period of life in a woman is a pregnancy where
the hormone is basically hormones, right?
It can be hormones, but there couldn't be two sleep apneas. Either it was just not diagnosed before because as it was believed it's a male disease, also all the screening tools were developed for the male symptoms. Whereas women...
So there's a different type of symptoms for females. Okay.
So men will typically... their wives will complain about their snoring or can describe the apneic events during the night, or they will be excessively sleepy. They are at the risk of microarousals when they are driving to fall asleep, cause car accident, for example.
Yeah.
They can be obese. They can have higher neck circumference. These are all the male stereotypical symptoms. Women, they will not come and tell you I'm snoring. And also their husbands will not come and tell you my wife is not. It's a social stigma. Even if they do, they will not tell you. But typically they will describe fatigue, chronic fatigue, chronic lack of energy, headaches, insomnia, irritability, anxiety, depression. These are all very non-specific.
It's very non-specific. And especially with, you know, woman being woman, they have a lot of, on their plates. They have kids and everything Then you would think that it's because of they're juggling so much things that they're tired all the time.
So they are very underdiagnosed. Yeah. And even the screening tools are not asking about the symptoms.
So
there's another thing. And during the pregnancy, these are all the symptoms of pregnancy. How to distinguish, right? There is no tool that can that can be used during pregnancy to effectively screen. Because there is no tool, the physicians are not screening, and there is also very low awareness among the OB doctors that there is a sleep apnea in pregnancy happening. But we know that it is happening.
Is it happening because of the pregnancy or is it before, just
so
underlying?
There are two types. One is that it was happening before and it just was not diagnosed.
Yeah.
And it gets worse during the pregnancy.
Okay.
And second one is new onset.
Okay, just like...
There's a gestational sleep apnea, new onset.
Okay.
So there are two types. But we, because we never checked the woman before, we have
we
no way to say which type. But it actually doesn't matter which one.
The treatment is the same, I guess.
But the thing is, because there is no proper screening tool, screening not happening, physician have poor awareness, and then this case is running underdiagnosed. And we know if the sleep apnea during pregnancy is untreated, it can contribute to develop a gestational diabetes, preeclampsia, which is quite serious.
It's like a high blood pressure, high blood pressure.
If you look in the research, a woman who experienced preeclampsia, if I'm not wrong, 1 in 3 women choose not to get pregnant again.
Yes, I heard. I think one of my friends had that, and they had to lie on the bed for a long time.
Yeah, so what's often happening is that the hypertension during pregnancy is being treated with different medications, and they are still not helping.
Because they're not really treating the root cause, right?
Yes. So that's an issue which have a simple solution, but it's just that awareness is very poor. So it doesn't trigger the alarm in the head of the physicians that, okay, maybe this is sleep apnea. And then we also know that not only the mother suffer, but 2 people at the same time suffer, the baby in the womb as well.
And there's lack of oxygen as well, right?
So because of the hypoxia and the lack of nutrients getting to the baby, these babies are usually smaller for their gestational age.
Okay.
They have a tendency, these cases have a tendency to come premature. Earlier, be a premature babies. Typically, their Apgar score is lower.
Okay.
They have higher chance to end up in ICU. And
it's quite profound,
Basically, the chance of having cesarean section is higher, whether during some acute hypertensive issue they need to induce mother. And then overall, the mother body will be more tired because she was fighting for her life during the sleep instead of getting rest. So she's naturally more tired. So the whole delivery is more difficult for her.
And then post-term as well, post-fashion as well. So
this is the issue with the gestational sleep apnea.
So wait, with gestational sleep apnea, it's worse because the tissues are just overall...
So we have, a multifactorial, so hormones play a role, especially estrogen, which will make the mucosa inside the nose and airways more thick, difficult to breathe.
And they're more flexible as well, something like that.
Sorry?
You're also more flexible, like more elastic.
It could be, yes. Could be. Then we have the baby that is growing inside the belly and pushing on the lungs and reducing the residual capacity, the lung volume. Yep. Yes. Yep. And then we have a fluid shift when the mother lay down, all the volumes goes inside the neck and it push on the airways, so makes more difficult to breathe, and then she gain weight because of the pregnancy, which again makes the airways more narrow. So there is a lot of factors that are contributing for the higher predisposition.
So as you know, as a newborn mother, I mean, my kid's 5 years old, 3 years old. But as a newborn mother, how do you identify whether it's a sleep apnea issue versus I'm just being a new mother? It's all this is because I'm pregnant.
Yeah.
That's very difficult to differentiate, I think.
This is actually very tricky.
Yes.
Very tricky. And I believe there is like no way.
There's no, no way. Because it's like, I think there is new. No way.
So yeah. That's why my research, what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to improve this area. And because I'm then an advocate that sleep apnea is so complex and the symptoms, especially during the pregnancy, are just so non-specific, trying to build a screening tool, like another screening questionnaire, will just not be effective. Now when we look in the research, we can see the studies that are confirming that the questionnaires, which we commonly use in dental practices or physicians, are not effective during the pregnancy. They cannot pick up effectively sleep apnea. So we need a different approach. And I believe we need a biomarker that will be accurately telling us what is happening in the woman's body. So
that'd be cool.
I believe this is the way how we can move forward. If we can give a simple tool into the OB's hands, that you just prescribe this one more blood test, and you will see that whether this biomarker is high, then you send to sleep physician.
Let's talk about watches and wearables, because that also is a marker that you can perhaps use. The Apple Watch measures oxygen and heart rate and everything like that, and respiratory rate. Is it how accurate it is? How much does the physician or the dentist can use that as a form of indicator?
So I'm not sure if I'm the right person to be asked this. Honestly, in this area, I didn't want to be so unaware, so I also got my smartwatch, but I just so uncomfortable, I cannot sleep with that.
It's true.
But many patients, they use it and they describe like, I was snoring or I had this sleep stage, that sleep stage. I'm like, okay, for the screening, maybe it's good as a screening tool, but I'm really not sure I can answer your question, especially during the pregnancy. I don't know. Honestly, I don't know.
No, I thought, because there's a lot of new wearables out there. There's like watches. I know there's a ring.
Rings, yes. I actually plan to buy the ring because the watch is so uncomfortable. It just bothers me. I don't like to wear it. So let's see if I will be able to wear the ring.
I bought a ring. It's quite cool. But I'm not a ring kind of guy, and I'm a dentist. So
maybe watch for you.
This is watch is fine. Yeah.
But I'm very new in this, and I don't feel like I'm the right expert in this wearable.
No, fair enough. But there's a lot of technology going into it. That's why I was.
Yeah, there is a lot, and especially now during the World Sleep that was happening here in Singapore recently, there was a lot of topics on wearables. Or I believe future is there. I still believe that it might be limited what we are getting from them now, but maybe when the technology improves itself and new softwares and everything, we can get more and more accurate data. But once again, I don't feel like I'm the expert in wearables. Yes.
No, but there's also another form of wearables where I think you gave it to my wife last time. It was this, who's Tiffany, because I was always suspecting she has sleep apnea.
Okay.
I always suspected. So, because she's always telling me, But it's because of kids, I think. She doesn't have sleep apnea. After I checked it out, I was like, okay. But so you gave her something to like test her oxygen level.
So there is difference between wearables which you just buy from like Apple or Samsung or over the counter.
Yeah, yeah.
And medical devices, which might resemble wearables because they are so simple.
Nowadays it's quite smooth, yeah.
But they have a different technology built in. So typically what is used is, now the newest one is, the mechanism is where we are measuring the peripheral artery tonometry. And from this one, we can even establish the sleep stages. And of course, there is...
How big is this?
So, for example, the one that we are using in my study, it looks like a watch.
Oh, okay.
And it has a probe on the finger. And it has one small sensor that we glue here.
On the chest. Okay.
Yeah, that's it.
Oh, that's, you can sleep really well, because usually if you sleep really study, my dad did a sleep study, it was like they plug everything on him and it's like so hard to sleep. Yeah. I mean, so it's not
very important to know that this is not a gold standard.
It is not a gold, but at least like a,
it's not
a screening
but
tool.
It was validated, okay, especially in pregnant women as well. So that's good. That's why we are using it. And because of lack of all the cables around the chest, during pregnancy might not be comfortable to wear. So our patient's just wearing a watch, basically, with the probe. Yes.
Yeah.
And the software is very sophisticated. It tells us whether she's snoring, or what is the sleep stages, how many percent of each sleep stages she has. Of course, the saturation, desaturation, pulse, even.
Wow.
Yeah, a lot of things.
Very cool, very cool. Because like my dad did a sleep study, and I don't know, man. Like, because I don't think I can sleep in a hospital for a day. I don't think.
This one is done at home. This one is
done at home, so it's a lot better now.
Yeah, so it's very comfortable, and it would not really bother you.
Yeah, no, but I think there's a lot of awareness of sleep nowadays, though.
Yes, because finally people start to understand that a healthy lifestyle is not only about a healthy diet and exercise,
it's about but sleep as well.
You really need to restore at night.
To function
properly. It was for a very long time believed that sleep is just a passive stage and there is nothing happening. Actually, only later research figured out that it's actually very much active stage, during which the body is going through a lot of restorative processes.
Yep. And like especially in the Asian culture, where if you think you're tired, it's just because you didn't have enough sleep. Like you just didn't sleep long enough.
But you can be sleeping how long you want if you are not breathing properly.
Oh, that's a very interesting thing to say. Yeah, okay, fair enough, because you still have micro sleeps and things like that.
Yeah, because you will not have all the benefits of your sleep. Yeah. So normally, if you are healthy, you don't have sleep apnea, you fall asleep and now everything slows down in your body, you know, blood pressure goes down, your body gets rest for the next day, right?
Yeah.
But what's happening during the sleep apnea is
that the body everything goes reverse.
Actually, you are not resting at all. You are fighting for your life because you are not being oxygenated enough, right? You stop breathing, your airways collapse, now your oxygen drops. Now what happens is that your heart starts to pump faster because it's trying to oxygenate the rest of your vital organs with the remaining oxygen that you have. CO2 will just go up and it will take some time for your brain to give you a sign that, oh, catch a breath. And then when this happens, it will actually prevent you from getting into the deep stages of sleep which you need to be able to function properly. So for example, we really need the entry sleep, a slow wave sleep, because it's a deep sleep during which our brain is being cleaned. In the brain, we have something like In the rest of the body, we have lymphatic system, right? To cleaning the metabolic waste.
Mm-hmm.
In the brain, we have glymphatic system.
Yeah.
And it operates mostly during the entry slow wave sleep.
Okay.
So the neurons during this stage shrinks, and then the cerebrospinal fluid starts to flow faster and
clean
all the metabolites.
Is it like brain? Does it have something to do with brain fogginess? You know, people say it's brain foggy.
Yeah. I mean, if you cannot clean the metabolic waste from your brain, you feel clear. So one of the important metabolites that you are cleaning is, for example, amyloid beta that is connected to Alzheimer's disease.
Oh, it's huge.
Yeah, so I'm not saying everyone who has sleep apnea will have
Alzheimer's. But it's a higher risk, yeah.
But there is a connection.
Yeah. Sleep apnea has like increased heart rate, increased heart disease, increased stroke, and so many other issues, you know.
So, yes, these patients with sleep apnea have a higher risk of experiencing stroke, especially in the second half of the night. And I would like to explain this. When you look at the sleep cycles during the night, in the first half of the night, they are a little bit different compared to the second half of the night. So in the first half of the night, we have this REM sleep, but REM sleep is shorter, much shorter.
REM is like rapid eye movement, right?
The eye movement one. And it's typical is the muscle atonia. When there is muscle atonia, you have the sleep apnea is worse because your muscles are atonic. So in the second half of the sleep, we have much more REM, longer episodes.
Okay.
Right. So during these stages, the body have to fight harder. The heart is pumping stronger, right? Mm. The blood pressure goes up. So if patient experiencing stroke, usually it's the second half of the night.
Because your heart is going faster.
You have a longer REM. Your body have to fight more strong. And I would like to mention...
So much information. So good.
I would like to mention that patients who wear CPAP, and we consider them as a compliant if they can wear it at least 4 hours a night. Typically wear it the first half of the night.
And they take it off because unconsciously,
and
right?
And they are not being treated during this crucial second half of the night. Whereas patients who wear typically wear it all the night.
Oh, because, And it's quite interesting because I have patients that say I wear the CPAP and then I don't know what I did in the night, but I always take it out at night. All right, it's so interesting to hear that. It's like, it means unconsciously you're just removing it. and they can't remember it.
So this is how some studies eventually claimed that the effect of oral appliance and CPAP is comparable.
Mm.
Because, maybe oral appliance cannot solve the sleep apnea completely, but can help you be treated throughout the whole night.
Yeah.
Whereas the CPAP, the compliance is lower, so they are only being treated first half of the night. Yeah, but they need also the second half where there is more REM and the body fights stronger.
It's a very good, very good tip. Okay.
I'm giving you a topic to discuss with your sleep physicians when you are trying to convince them that, hey, send me the
tape. And how's the sentiment of the sleep physicians? Are they, I know their gold standard is still CPAP.
Mm. The sleep physicians would be more cooperative if the dentist can prove themselves. If they can prove that, firstly, I respect you. You are the one who is doing the diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
You are the one who referred the patient to me, and I'm the one that will help you to manage this patient.
Mm.
And once I'm done with him, I will send him back to you to check if I do a good job.
So typically what you do is you do a sleep study. Then after that, do all the treatment and then you do another sleep study to check.
So I do sleep studies in my clinic.
Okay.
Because I use it for the titration or the calibration of my appliances. So typically the workflow, if I'm to mention what's happening in Prague, is the patient is referred to me by sleep physician. Whether this patient is, I never saw him before and they just referred to me, or sometimes I see patients and I send to them first for the proper diagnosis, then they send back to me.
Yeah.
So the patient come to my office. We do our clinical examination. We build together the oral appliance with the patient. And then we have the calibration period where we are finding the therapeutic position. When we think that we found it, we run a sleep test within our facilities to see how the AHI index went down, how the saturation went up, how the snoring reduced, to have some objective data, not only subjective patient's feelings.
Because you just ask, usually what you do with calibration, you just how are you feeling,
you feel better, kind of thing. I need an objective data. So then based on that, I see, okay, we have some effect, but maybe we will slightly protrude more, or maybe we see, okay, we are good already. So whenever I get to the final stage, that okay, this is maximum what I can do with this patient, then I send back to the physician and he can see whether he is comfortable with what I did.
I want to ask also, it's been quite long. I want to ask is that can someone with a certain protrusion, that means you protruded them like 50%, and the patient's quite happy, and then but because he's getting bigger and bigger and bigger and more opaque, like obese, things like that, do we need to protrude them even more next time?
So as I mentioned before, it's very crucial the patient come for follow-up
visit. Yes, yes, yeah.
And you are checking not only the integrity of the oral appliance and the possible bite changes or any side effects, but you are also visually observing the patient.
Size, right? And everything, yes. Yeah.
In my office, we have a weight, so we are checking their weight also.
Okay.
Objective data. Oh,
yeah. Okay.
So
okay,
we can see the trend, whether they gain weight or they lose weight.
Mm.
And currently, it is recommended to use appliances that are positional, like you can move them forward, but also backward.
Because if I lose weight also,
yes,
right?
Yeah. If they lose weight and we run, either we run the sleep study or we ask the physician to run sleep study, and we know what's happening now with the patient after, let's say, 1 year follow-up visit, and we can see, okay, maybe the HI reduced.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we try a little bit also or reduce or sometimes you see HI increase, then we try to protrude little.
Yeah,
bit
that means
more.
Reviews are so important because it's not just you just fix it and then forever you use the same thing.
No.
Yeah.
Okay. And then also these appliances have a lifespan, usually 3 to 5 years.
Yeah.
So it is also important to always check if they are in a good condition. Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Cool. Well, I think we have all the time that we have. Thank you so much, Simona. It was really, really, really interesting. I think I learned much more here than in dental school about sleep. So thank you so much. If you like this episode, please like and subscribe. I'll see you in the next episode. Thank you.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you so much. It was great. Enjoyed it a lot.
Thank you.